Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's June 30th, 2015, and we come live from the Mud Hut in Southwest New Mexico with our studio audience. Studio audience. Yay! So we are broadcasting via Skype in a very rural area, so we apologize in advance for any technical or audio difficulties. It may cut in and out at times because, quite frankly, folks, we're in the middle of nowhere. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks from Afrozin, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. In a few minutes, we have our guest, activist Cindy Sheehan, with us. But first, let's briefly catch up with Guy, who's been on the road for about 2.5 weeks in his tour on the Pacific Northwest, and he has some thoughts about his tour.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to see you again. It's been a while.
It's really good to see you, too.
And I should point out that this is not the middle of nowhere, although we can see it from here. It's just right around the corner.
He's got jokes.
And that's as good as they get, too. So studio audience can join in at any time with laughter. There you go. Don't make me hold up the sign, folks. So I'm just back from a speaking tour where I was accompanied by Paul Marcotte, a friend of mine who's here visiting the Mud Hut now and is part of the expansive studio audience. Paul was enlisted to do two things for me. One, remind me to take my medication every day. He failed every day with that, by the way. And two, he was my personal assistant, as he called it, for idiot control. Keep the idiots away, I said, but do it nicely. And he did, except for that drunk guy who came up in the middle of my presentation and stood right in my face. I was at the microphone. But security eventually showed up and took care of that.
You have security detail.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, I mean, they do at the Heartwood Cafe. In whatever town we were in.
Right.
Duncan, I think.
Duncan.
Home of the donuts, apparently. Wow. Don't make me hold up the sign, studio audience. Jeez, what did I do?
It's their first time.
Anyway,
some of them.
The signature comment came from somebody who's been following my work for a long time. She picked us up at the Port Angeles Ferry Station and took us to Bremerton. So this is our first time in the United States. After three presentations over 3 days in British Columbia. And Jean picked us up at the ferry station. It was an hour or two drive back to her place. And just about the first thing she said is, I've been following your work for many years, and yet abrupt climate change surprised me this year. She's a lifelong gardener. She's been gardening in that place for a couple of decades. And she typically gets two cuttings from her arugula. She got none before it all bolted. She has three varieties of cherries, early, middle, and late. And we got there before summer began. And she called all of her cherry trees the same variety, overripe.
Wow.
Drying on the tree. Mm. The drought has kicked in. The drought that has been in California for 4 years has now extended all the way up the coast. And anybody who's paying attention has noticed. Other hosts we stayed with said you could never see the top of the ridge before because the conifer trees were so dense. But this year, the conifer trees have so few leaves on them that you can clearly see the top of the ridge from their home. So these were a couple of examples. I should point out, returning to Paul Marcotte, my personal assistant on this tour, that he was really stressed on a couple of occasions. People walked in right as I began to speak, 5 minutes into the presentation. Some guy walks in and declares that he is paranoid schizophrenic. And I'm not sure if I was in that state, I would announce it to the entire audience.
Right.
And he needed 2 minutes at the beginning of the presentation to read something to us. It was actually climate change bonds. He was starting a petition like war bonds in World War II. Right. So he thinks if we just raise enough money, we can stop.
Is that easy?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like selling Girl Scout cookies.
Well,
but different.
But a little different because it only requires a petition. You, right. you only have to sign a petition, and right. then the government is going to issue climate change bonds, uh-huh. green bonds, and we'll fix this whole thing. Did I mention he admitted that he was crazy? There you go. There's a studio audience I've been counting on. And a similar event happened later with somebody who had a fix for climate change. And so this is at a book reading in Eugene, Oregon. And this guy raises his hand very politely. He's all the way in the back. And I called on him, and he started walking to the front. And I thought, no good could come of this. But there was no stopping him. And he came to the front, and he had a little model, a little papier-mâché model with four or five soda straws sticking out of it. And it was his plan to cool the ocean. He said, we just put these out in the ocean, and it creates this low-pressure system, and pretty soon water is spewing all over the place, and the planet is cooled just like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he didn't claim to be crazy, but I didn't think much of that idea.
But straws.
Soda straws. Yeah, it was just a model.
Oh.
It wasn't the whole completed.
I wouldn't have gotten near you at the presentation being that the idiot thing there.
And I told him basically that he was talking to the wrong person because right. I can't fix this.
Okay.
I'm not going to make the soda straw models into real things.
Right. You don't have that much power.
Right, exactly. Right. I'm pathetic in terms of my power. And so I did convince him right away to go away. And so he just stepped politely off to the side and wow. took his model with him. I thought that was nice. I should point out to everybody on the air and in the live studio audience that Myrtle the Goose has just laid her every other day egg.
Yay.
I see her emerging from the shrub right now, that four-winged saltbush where she always puts her egg. So good news, folks. At least one of us is going to eat tonight.
Yay.
So, any other, I don't know, escapades? I guess my question always is, when you go on these, because you've been to the Northwest several times, and is it different every time? I mean, that seems to me to be the stereotypical accepting part of the country, you know, the liberal part of the country. And what do you find? Is it pretty much the same everywhere you go?
No, it's actually, I've seen more people reaching the acceptance phase than ever before okay. in the last couple of tours in Western Europe and then the most recent tour in Cascadia. And it used to be, for the first 2.5 years I was doing this, it was very predictable. There's 10 or 15% of the audience that is in complete acceptance. They right. followed my work for a long time. They just came to see me.
Acceptance of climate change or abrupt climate change?
Acceptance of abrupt climate change.
And near-term human extinction?
Yes.
Okay. So you drop
absolutely.
Both, you drop both bombs.
Right.
And
bingo. The okay. bombs are inextricably connected
right.
to each other. And so 10 or 15% of the people show up and they know what I'm going to say and they show up anyway.
Right.
And they don't claim to be cray-cray.
Right.
And another 10 or 15% accept climate change, but absolutely believe that we can do something about this and that I'm crazy for suggesting otherwise. And these are the people who quote the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change
right.
and very mainstream media kinds of sources.
Kind and of so, conservative estimates, things
yeah,
like that. Right?
Yeah. And so I get some pushback from them. This has been the case all the way up through March of this year.
Okay.
And then there's the middle 70% or so who understand climate change, they know it's anthropogenic, they get that whole thing, but it's happening so much faster than they expected. They didn't think it was this bad.
Okay.
They thought it was a problem for the grandchildren to solve because they've been reading the media reports that come out in the wake of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessments.
Right.
So they just think it's always a problem to be solved in 2100.
Okay. So,
but they don't push back. You know, they
right.
sort of accept where we're at.
Okay. I mean, so, but I guess what boggles my mind is that what pushed this individual to the point of acceptance, were her cherries going bad?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard of, I get there's moments, you know, we have that moment in your life where you her to another path. But
right. No, she accepted the idea of abrupt climate change affecting the ability to grow food. She got that. But she thought it would happen to other people first.
Oh, I see.
You know, so yeah, it's like every time I...
Not me, but...
Every time I quote Paul Beckwith, you know, we're going to have a 5 or more degree Celsius temperature rise
right.
within a decade or two. Every time I mention that, and I say it was late November of last year, everybody I talk to afterwards says, oh, so I'm going to die on November 30th, 2034, because that's the last possible day. So everybody just assumes that the worst will be reserved for everybody else. And the best will happen for me.
Right.
And so if I went around telling people human extinction occurs on January 3rd, 1980 or 2084,
right.
everybody would assume that they would all die the same day.
Right. Well, that'd be the Hollywood ending.
Right, yes.
Throwing the rock.
And so she was in that same place.
Right.
You know, she lives in this place, the Pacific Northwest. It's been cool and wet up until a year ago or so. And so she just assumed that that would continue indefinitely and that abrupt climate change would affect a whole bunch of other people before it affected her.
Right. Well, I guess it's kind of part of the hope.
Well, yeah, and the tagline always is faster than expected.
Right. Absolutely.
So all these things are happening faster, sooner, stronger than expected.
Yeah.
And I mean, the best example of that now is the wildfires in Alaska this year that have burned more already than 2000 through the year 2014 combined. That's what's burned so far this year, and the fire season is just getting started.
Okay. Well, on that note... All right, let's move on to our interview this week. And this week we have our guest, Cindy Sheehan. And Cindy Sheehan is an American activist whose son, U.S. Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, was killed by enemy action during the Iraq War. She attracted national and international media attention in 2005 for extended anti-war protest at a makeshift camp outside President George W. Bush's Texas Ranch, a stand that drew both passionate support and angry criticism. Sheehan ran unsuccessfully as an independent for Congress in 2008, coming in second to Nancy Pelosi with nearly 17% of the vote. Sheehan was a 2012 vice presidential nominee for the Peace and Freedom Party and received 1.2% of the vote of the statewide vote in the 2014 California gubernatorial election. She is a vocal critic of President Barack Obama's foreign policy. Her memoir, Peace Mom, A Mother's Journey Through Heartache, to Activism was published in 2006. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Cindy.
Hi, thank you so much.
I want to start with your journey because of the title of your memoir.
May I just mention a couple things from the bio?
Absolutely.
Okay, I just want to clarify a couple things. I am also a passionate critic of Barack Obama's domestic policies, so not just his foreign policy.
Right.
I mean, we're fighting this huge personal battle right now. When my sister has advanced stage aggressive breast cancer, and we're not just fighting against the cancer, we're fighting to get her treatment and everything she needs to become healthy. And also, you know, that he gave himself fast track authority to approve treaties. And that's certainly, I have a lot of problems with the Constitution and the establishment, but certainly the president, that's not one of the president's enumerated duties under the Constitution. And then when people say that Casey, my son Casey, was killed by enemy fire or something, I think really he never believed the people of Iraq were his enemies, and I think he was put there by the enemies of peace and of the people, and that's the U.S. imperial establishment war machine or whatever. I just want to clarify who the real enemies are.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I've heard some interviews with you where you talk about your son and what he was actually doing there, and I wondered if you can expand upon that a little bit.
Well, you know, he joined the military in 2000, right after he completed his, you know, as much as he could at a community college,
right.
And earned his AA in theater arts. But, you know, he wanted to go on to university, and he felt like, you know, that was too much for our family and for him to handle. And so he was preyed upon by a recruiter who, you know, promised him all kinds of wonderful things if he joined the military. And he did. And so near the end of his first term, he was deployed to Iraq, and he was a Humvee mechanic. He was just there for a few days before he was killed by people who were just defending their community from a violent, oppressive invasion.
Your journey as a person and as a mother, activist, and political candidate and citizen of this country is, I think, a very important one. And you've kind of given us some insight on where you've been a little bit. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, where you've been and kind of where you are and where you hope to go for someone who really fills, you know, many roles.
Where I've been, well, you know, I started out just as a, well, I don't want to say just. When Casey was killed, I was, you know, working full time. We were struggling to make ends meet, like many families here in the United States. And, you know, our biggest struggle, ironically, was that my ex-husband, who was my husband at the time, Casey, the father of all my children, he was an independent contractor, so our struggle was to keep health insurance. And so I either had to work at a job that we got health insurance, or, you know, we had to pay a lot of money for insurance. So really, certainly, Obamacare hasn't improved that condition. But anyway, we cared about these issues. We were against the wars. We were against George Bush, as was Casey. But then we didn't really, like, have the... We didn't know where we could express that. We live in a very conservative community in Vacaville, California. It's right next to an Air Force base. It's the largest employer of people here in this community, besides the prisons. We also have two prisons. And so the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex are the biggest employers here in Vacaville. And so it's very conservative. There's a lot of retired military here. We felt like we were the only ones in this whole town that were against the wars and against George Bush. And so after Casey was killed, I just had the time to do more research and more making connections with other people who felt the same way I did. And interestingly enough, with other family members of or parents or brothers and sisters, or aunts and uncles of brothers and sisters of you know, our military who had been killed in Iraq or Afghanistan that felt the same way that we did. So at the end of 2004, the year Casey was killed, and the beginning of 2005, I founded, along with my sister, the one who has breast cancer right now, we founded Gold Star Families for Peace. Now, Gold Stars is something that a mother gets when her child is killed in war. And so, to me, I call it some kind of demented Boy Scout badge or something that we get. And so we just thought that the mothers aren't the only ones that are affected by this kind of loss, that it really can tear apart families as it tore apart my marriage, but not my family. And so we thought that we would just found this organization, because the Gold Star Mothers of America, they're very conservative. They're very pro-war. They really support the troops, my government, right or wrong, those kinds of people. So we organized Gold Star Families for Peace, and then we just started making more connections, got more visible in the anti-war community. And then, you know, in August of that year is when I first went to Crawford to confront George Bush. And so that's pretty much. And then I was against George Bush. I was against the wars. But then I just became, I just evolved into realizing that doesn't matter if you have a Democrat or Republican in office. It doesn't matter if Congress is controlled by Democrats or Republicans. There's people behind that that are actually pulling the strings or lining their bank accounts, and they're the ones who have the power in this country. And so I've become like an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, which I think is far more wide-ranging than just being anti-war or anti-Republican war, of course.
Well, that really kind of leads into your book, The Obama Files, Chronicles of an Award-Winning War Criminal. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the book and some of the pushback, because obviously, you know, the left, when you're against W, everybody's like, yeah, but when you start pushing against their guy, what is some of that, the pushback you felt from that?
Well, I started feeling that pushback in 2008 when I was running against Pelosi. And so that was the first year Obama was running too, right? So I was a supporter of Cynthia McKinney, who was running for the Green Party that year. But anyway, in 2006, 2007, when the Democrats regained power, control of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House, and I felt like they lied to us and stabbed us in the back, especially the anti-war activists who they used to get back in power. And so I started to really, you know, I've met Barack Obama several times prior to his running for president in 2008. Was never that impressed. I never liked him that much. Yeah. But then when he started running, I started actually listening to what he was saying rather than his slogans. And so he never said he was against war. He never said he was for peace. He never, you know, he always said that he would use a nuclear option against Iran if nothing was off the table against Iran. Ronald Reagan was his favorite president, for gosh sakes. That's what he said. And he said that, you know, he would not prosecute the Bush administration for anything because we have to look forward, not backwards. And so I was never in favor of him in the first place. I was never a supporter, never voted for him one time. And in 2009, after he was inaugurated, 3 days after he was inaugurated, was his first drone strike in northern Waziristan that killed dozens of innocent people. And so I sent something out to my email list at the time, and I said, look, it didn't take him very long to become a presidential war criminal. Oh, my God. Right. You just could have. I could have just watched people unsubscribing from my list, you know, thousands of people unsubscribed from my list that day. But, wow. You know, it's not like I would turn around and apologize because I actually was correct. And Barack Obama and his supporters were incorrect. And, you know, all life is precious, not just when Republicans kill them. And so anyway, the Obama Files is actually a collection of my articles, observations, essays, or whatever since Barack Obama became president. So it's not just like a chronicle of Barack Obama and his war crimes and crimes against humanity, but it really is also a chronicle of the abdication of the left and really the demise of the anti-war movement since Barack Obama came into office. And it's a couple hundred pages long, almost 300 pages long, I think, but I had to cut a whole lot out of it, or it would have been about 500 pages long. So, and then, of course, it just covered 6 years of his administration. I just thought, if there's not enough proof by now that he that Barack Obama is just as much of a tool and an able servant of empire as George Bush was.
Absolutely.
Cindy, this is Guy McPherson. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I agree it doesn't matter which of the two major parties are, quote, in power. I have for years been calling them the twin cheeks of the corporate ass.
Right.
And I also don't think this is about capitalism. I think it goes deeper than that. I think it goes to the very roots of civilization. And yet I hear Bernie Sanders is going to save us and so on. Can you talk a little bit about how, does it end at capitalism for you? Is that the problem? If we had socialism, do you think that would be better? What's the solution? What's the answer from your perspective?
Well, Bernie Sanders, first of all, is not a socialist. He's a very mild democratic socialist with heavy on the Democrat. And, you know, as soon as Bernie Sanders joined the war party, the party of Wall Street, the party of oppression, like you said, just one of the cheeks of the ass of empire, that's when I was like, forget about it. I'm not even looking at him anymore. But I think that the solution is... it's like an organic socialism that I heard you guys talking a little bit before you came to me. And I think the answer is localization. And I think the answer is cooperatives and things like that. And I don't think that there's going to be much social structure left after the collapse, and the collapse is inevitable. And so I think that we need to, I think social structure, I mean from like institutionally from the top down. Mm-hmm. So I've long been, since Barack Obama was elected and I kind of got shoved aside, kind of got fired from my job as anti-war leader because there was no anti-war. I started to really, I wrote a book called Myth America, The 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. And it was almost, and it kind of started at the same time as the idea of transition towns started and things like that. So, you know, I think that that is the answer. I don't think that there will be a lot of energy or resources for any kind of institutional solutions to our problems. And, you know, it's going to turn into more local and regional economies because that's just going to be necessary.
Do you see something like collapse happening before, the citizenry of this country would ever revolt?
I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, I've been doing this now since my son was killed, and that's not a very long time compared to how long some other people have been in these movements, movements for peace, social justice, the environment, you know, and I think it's all linked, so it's really hard for me to, you know, compartmentalize these movements like some people do, because I think that they're all very intimately and intricately linked. And yeah. So anyway, I just like, but I have done it like more than some people in 10 years. I've done like way more than some people have done in 40 years. So I've been around the world. I've run for office. I've written like 7 or 8 books by now. And so I have my podcast, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, that I've had since 2009. So really, I've been at it pretty, strongly in those years. So I've seen a lot. I've observed a lot. I've had many interactions. And I really think that the robber class, I call them, you know how Occupy called them the 1%, right? Like 2 years after I wrote Myth America. I think that they just are very clever. You know, they're greedy and they want everything. That's the only thing they want is everything. but they know how to distribute the crumbs. And so as long as those crumbs keep coming, the people of the United States will not move one inch out of their comfort zones.
Right.
And yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah, it seems to me that every time there maybe seems to be, and for me it's just simply a feeling of discontent, something happens where it makes at least the people in my life on the left kind of puff their chest out and say something like, well, see, the system works after all.
Right.
And they ignore the fact that the system is what's actually putting the injustice there in the first place.
Right.
And it's happened a lot, you know, over the last 2 weeks with, you know, some of the rulings and things that have been passed. And so when I talk to folks about criticizing the left, it seems to me they're so identified with it that they tend to negotiate their way out of the narrative that they've, you know, kind of found themselves trapped in. Because, mm-hmm. you know, they would ask for pretty much W's head. But, you know, you mentioned the drone strikes, and I mention that all the time. And it's like I can mention it over and over, and these people, they glaze over. It's like it doesn't matter.
And the National Defense Authorization Acts of 2012, 2013, 2014, right. signed by this president, that strip us of all rights for being citizens. It's inane. This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're interviewing Cindy Sheehan, activist and author.
I want to switch gears a little because you've mentioned the Affordable Care Act several times, and you wrote a piece on your blog about your experiences with the act. And in it, you mentioned you reached out anonymously and have had, you know, you've heard different horror stories about the impact this act is having on people. And I was wondering if you could share some insight, what you've learned both personally and from others about, you know, quote unquote, Obamacare.
Well, you know, it does like work for a small amount of people. And, you know, for example, my daughter, she can get cheap health care because she's a, you know, she has a master's degree. She's got $60,000 in student loans. And, you know, she's working as a bartender in San Francisco with her master's degree. She jokes that you need a master's degree to be a bartender in San Francisco. But, you know, poor people are still being left out of something that I believe is a human right that transcends every culture has some kind of right to health care. Some are way better than other countries, of course. But, you know, the United States still ranks something like 48th among so-called industrialized nations in health care. And the problem with Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, is, first of all, it's not very affordable for most people. You know, it's just like, you know, people are saying how much more their premiums have increased since it was passed in, whenever it took effect. People are saying that, you know, they're being fined on their taxes not having something they can't afford in the first place. And then people who got subsidies are now being taxed on those subsidies. And so when you have a for-profit system, and healthcare should not be for profit, this is what's happening. And my sister personally, she and I both were like Affordable Care Act, Obamacare Act conscientious objectors. We believe that health care and holistic health care, not just, you know, Western medicine type, is a human right. And we opposed the Affordable Care Act, or the Obamacare, wholeheartedly opposed it. So, and we're also war tax resistors, so we don't pay our taxes anyway.
Oh.
So we were just like, we can't, you know, we can't in good conscience sign up for something that we're being forced to purchase. Our government is forcing us to purchase a private product. To me, that sounds awfully fascist. And so something that really isn't good. These products have high deductibles and low rates of coverage. So when Dee Dee got sick, we had to enroll her in Medi-Cal. And so she was going to USC, and USC now in Los Angeles is the county hospital. And she was in the chair. She's got stage 3 aggressive rare breast cancer. And so even the alternative doctor we were able to go see up here in Northern California said that she needed chemo to shrink the tumor. And she was in Los Angeles in the chair getting ready for chemo, and they denied her, and they sent her home and said, we don't take your coverage. But it's Medi-Cal. How can a county hospital not take Medi-Cal?
So, I mean, I don't know how you're keeping your sanity with some of these things you're dealing with in your
life. It's like I'm having a really hard time with this, of course. But then she came up north. I live in Northern California. After she was denied at USC, I said, come up here. You know, we'll just try and get you care up here at one of our university hospitals. They all take Medi-Cal. And so she had to go to the emergency room, and within 5 days she had chemo. So we found a compassionate niche in the healthcare system, which is so rare. We feel so fortunate as poor people that she's getting this kind of care. So it really has been a total nightmare.
Yeah.
We have to fight for her life, but we have to fight the establishment to get her, you know, help. So it's just, and then I feel we have so many resources because we have hundreds of people, if not thousands of people across the country who are, you know, rooting for us and helping us and giving us all this advice and support. You know, she has a GoFundMe page that's raised almost $9,000 for her alternative treatments, like, you know, cannabis oil and things like that. We're taking her to an alternative doctor too. But so we're lucky. We're poor, but we're lucky. What about people who don't have as much support as we do? It just makes me crazy, and it breaks my heart, really. This country is so heartless and so callous.
And I was going to ask you, you know, how you do balance that, because I follow you on Facebook, and I listen to your show from time to time and read your blog, and you just keep on keeping on. And I was wondering, you know, if there's some sort of secret, but you seem very, very durable. And I was wondering how you do it.
Well, I don't know. I really have no idea. Just know I try. In 2006, I almost died. And this is like a very good activist story because I was exhausted. I was like flying all over the world, going to Crawford several times a year. This was in 2006.
Okay.
I was on a fast for 40 days when I ended up in the emergency room, and I lost a lot of blood from female issues, and so I had to have blood transfusion surgeries, and I was literally laying in bed in Seattle at the Veterans for Peace conference, and I felt my spirit leave my body. Mm-hmm. And right at that time, my boyfriend at the time called, and I was like, oh, hi, you know, I'm just laying here, and you know, my spirit just left. And so he called my friends, and they got me to the hospital. And so then I learned that if you don't take care of yourself, nobody's going to take care of you. Right. And so I started to eat right, rest more, get more exercise, start to say no, because, you know, I just felt like if I threw everything I had, 100% of myself into this cause, that the wars would end. And so I did throw 100% of myself. I almost died. The wars haven't ended yet. So I just have a more holistic approach to things. It's actually, and this is so cliche, but it's true. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And one of the things that we can do as activists is to recognize when fellow activists are on the verge of burnout or being sick, them making themselves sick, and to step in and not just like step in and scold them, but step in and say, what can I do to help? Because you obviously need, and just counsel people. It doesn't work every time because I can see that fire in people's eyes. But fires can only blaze for a short time. It's the embers that keep going. And so we have to fan those embers of ourselves to keep ourselves going on a day-to-day basis. And then don't be afraid to take a break. Because I can guarantee you the wars and everything will still be happening when you come back.
Yeah, I'm inclined to call them conquest, not wars. It's pretty one-sided, but
yeah, maybe. Exactly. It's not really wars. It's imperial conquest, like you said.
Yeah. I'm impressed with your comment about taking care of yourself, and you also mentioned localization, what I would call relocalization, because we spent a long time of the human experience there.
Right.
It sounds like you're an anarchist, as I am.
Yeah, you know, I think I lean towards that way. The only reason I've gotten involved in electoral politics is because I had some kind of, you know, Pollyanna idea that it would get the issues into the conversation. Mm-hmm. But I wrote a book after I ran against Pelosi called I Left My Marbles in San Francisco. The scandal of federal electoral politics, and they really, the establishment really puts up insurmountable roadblocks to anybody that is outside the mainstream patriarchal Democrat Republican kind of paradigm. They put up insurmountable roadblocks. And I know in the introduction you said I was not successful in my run against Pelosi, but we thought after everything we had to go through, even to just get on the stinking ballot, right. To get on the stinking ballot was a 5-month campaign. And so everything that we had to go through, we thought 17% and coming in second was a victory, and I would like rally my staff and the interns and the volunteers every morning, and I'd say, you know, God damn it, we won again because we kept the office open and we're still in the race. You know, every day was a victory. That we had so much vandalism too. We had people smashing our windows. We had computers stolen. We had the campaign vehicle broken into. And some of it can be because of San Francisco and, you know, that thing. But it just got to be so much that it seemed like there was, you know, hanky-panky from the other side, from the Democrats. Now, the Democrats in San Francisco, not just Pelosi, they hated our guts. And, you know, they were very virulently against our campaign. So then we also, that day of the elections, we had people, teams going out to each precinct and doing exit polling. And we had some smart people doing the exit polling. I was polling between 30 and 60% at every poll we went to. But then I ended up getting 17%.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's almost as if the game is rigged.
But even Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, and she wasn't going to let any snot-nosed independent come in. And even if I had gotten 20%,
right,
that would have really, in politics, that would have been like a huge slap to her power.
Right, so again, it sounds to me like the game is rigged, that they're the twin chiefs of the corporate ass, and that there's very little, if anything, we can do on the political front.
Right. I agree. I totally agree. And but I think working on local issues and local organizing, I went all over the country, like 60 different cities when I wrote Myth America in 2009. And it seemed like a lot of good local stuff was happening in communities. And it didn't really matter if you were a Democrat or Republican or a Green or an anarchist or whatever, because they're local issues that affect everybody. And so to me, that was more, I saw more community building happening around those kinds of issues, and those kinds of things.
So is there a way forward? Is there a way out of this localization trap that will get traction beyond what happens in your town and in your city?
I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know. But I think that this empire that we are citizens of or slaves to will collapse, and it's inevitable. And so are we going to let it collapse on us, or are we going to build some kind of safety net that's, I'm mixing my metaphors, but so that we can survive it? Because, I've been to Cuba many times, and Cuba's still recovering from the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was their major supporter and major trade partner until it collapsed. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cubans were already growing their own food, already had community councils. And so they were able to get organic and alternative kinds of farming going fairly rapidly. I'm just afraid here is, what are we going to do? Jackhammer up some parking lots or whatever to start growing food. But then I just rode my bike across the country. Well, it was actually 2 years ago. I rode from California to Washington, D.C. Took us 3 months. That was amazing. And it was the same kind of thing. We were going from community to community. Sometimes we had planned stops. Sometimes we had unplanned stops and interactions with people along the way. But like in Detroit is like the avant-garde of the collapse of capitalism and empire. And so we saw some amazing things, community things happening in Detroit, where they have actually taken parking lots and parking structures, and they're growing food in them. So I think there is a way out, and there's a way out, and it's building community and trusting ourselves and not trusting the establishment. And if that sounds like it's too 60s or hippie-ish, I mean, it's absolutely true. As people here in the United States, we want to trust our government. We want to have as least involvement in things as possible, and just let it go, and hopefully, be optimistic that the smart people will make things turn out okay. But where are the smart people? Where are the ones? We know what we need, and we're the ones. We grow our own food here. We, do a lot of alternative healing, and my daughter is an amazing co-op organizer, and we do a lot of trading services all the time in the community. And it looks like we're going to be doing public homeschooling, because California passed a thing that all kids have to have all their thousands of vaccinations before they can go to school. So it looks like we're going to be partnering with other people to do homeschooling coming up soon with my grandchildren. So I think that's the way out. The way out is trusting ourselves and trusting each other and trying to make a better life for ourselves. But I also have my global activism too. So we do that while we can.
Well, on those wise words, we thank you, and we are honored for your time. Thank you, Cindy Sheehan, for spending time on NatureBats Last with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and sorry it was so hard to connect with, but it's been nice chatting with you.
It was worth the wait. We thank you very much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Cindy Sheehan, American activist, mother, and really somebody to kind of model your activism around, somebody who's really steadfast.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, her commitment to local action matched with the idea of global action that she's been pursuing for more than a decade is quite impressive. Yes. Her understanding the tenuous nature of this set of living arrangements and what comes next is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, she's one of the few guests, we really have a hard time getting guests in this show who we really want to talk to, learn from, and listen to, in some cases, they can talk about things that really matter. And she's one of the people that she really likes connections, and she connects a lot of different avenues, and it's rare to find, and it's good to listen to.
Yeah, now, to be fair, most people don't like to listen to us either, so it's sort of a two-way street.
It's true. We got to get better radio voices.
Yeah, I already have a great face for radio. What do you want?
I have rosacea, so I don't. All right. So, do we have any climate news for this week? I mean, clearly, north of us is on fire.
Right. In fact, the area burned in Alaska this year exceeds that burn in 2000 through 2014 combined.
Yeah.
So,
and you barely hear about it.
Right. Barely hear about it. And summer just started.
Right.
What, a little over a week ago.
Right.
So really the fire season is just getting rolling. And it's not just there. It's British Columbia. It's many places it's Alberta.
Alberta, right.
Look at the maps of, the fire maps of Alberta.
What's going on with Alberta, Paul?
Yeah, well, burn those tar sands down.
Yeah, there you go.
Burn the prisons to the ground.
Right.
And the tar sands are a prison. I haven't been mentioning climate change updates on the show because I've been traveling for a while. But there's a paper from the 10th of June, the 19th of June in Science Advances, and in the abstract it says the sixth mass extinction is already underway. So finally, nearly 5 years after the United Nations reports that 150 to 200 species are being driven to extinction every day, finally the conservative, academically oriented voices catch up. Oh, the sixth mass extinction is underway.
If it feels like an extinction event, it smells like one.
Maybe it is one. The senior author on that paper was interviewed the same day, and he says, quote, life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on. So
we got that one.
Yeah, so he actually understands the concept of habitat because he's a biologist.
Right.
And the people I get the most pushback from are engineers and physicists who think that we can live on the International Space Station. What could possibly go wrong? Or we could live in nuclear submarines,
right?
For example, right. And just come up when we needed food. Well, there's not going to be food up there.
And who would want to live that?
I mean, unless you really like Twinkies. Hey, it doesn't sound that bad. When you put it that way.
And, you know, that's the thing. You know, I often get accused of it's not sort of being accused, but, you know, of being a prepper. And I don't know if I necessarily want to live in a world where people are in bunkers and poking their heads out every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Statue of Liberty is buried in sand.
We have a Statue of Liberty still? I thought we gave that back. Yeah. We're not using it anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And another paper. This is from the 6th of June in PLOS Biology. All these quotes and links to the original articles can be found at the Long Climate Change Submarine Update at the blog. Here's the title of that paper in PLOS Biology. Quote, suitable days for plant growth disappear under projected climate change. And the projected, of course, is 2100.
Yeah.
Because it's just like when I mentioned at the beginning of the show, when I mentioned a date, everybody thinks they're going to live that long. Well, apparently, as far as the academic science is concerned, everything happens on January 1st.
Right.
Up until then, climate change is never a problem.
Yeah. There's a lot of the end of the century talk, I noticed.
Yeah. The switch will be flipped.
Right. And I think because that's the way the question's always phrased. You know, where do you see us? Is the given by the end of the century?
Right.
Like somehow the end of the century is going to be the given, and that's going to happen.
Right. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate change has been telling us for more than a quarter of a century that we need to reduce emissions or there's trouble ahead. And the trouble ahead, further ahead,
right,
further away, as emissions keep going up and up and up. This is the moving the goalposts phenomenon. Anyway, it gets better. That's not all there is. There's a subtitle to that paper as well. The subtitle is, and I quote, potential human and biotic vulnerability, as if the inability to grow plants is a potential problem.
Right.
And human and biotic, like there's two things in the world. Yeah. There's humans and there's life.
Right.
Human and biotic vulnerability.
Right.
Humans are vulnerable and so is life.
Right. Well,
apparently the singularity is done by then.
Yeah.
So we aren't really even human anymore. We're post-human. So we got
we're Americans, guy. American exceptionalism. We can do anything.
Repeat after me.
War bonds.
We're number one.
We're number one. And we're about to go number two. Right on. So, anything else?
Or isn't that enough?
I guess it is. Well, that about wraps it up this week, folks. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook page group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM, and feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. And please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and future speaking tours. And we'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. And if you missed the show, you make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again for our guest, Cindy Sheehan, and her voice and her insight. Thanks to Afrozen for his music. And until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Bye.